Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, 8th Canto, Chapter 8, The Churning of the Milk Ocean, Text 9. Tasyam chakruspiham sarve sasura suramanava rupo daryo vayo varna mahimakshipta chetasa tasyam chakruspiham sarve Sasura Suramanava Rupaudhaya Vayuvarna Mahima Shipta Chetasa Tasyam Chakruspiham Sarve Sasura Suramanava Rupaudhaya Vayo Varna Mahima Shipta Chetasa. Vaishnavis, Tasyam, unto her. Chakru, did. Spriham, desire. Sarve, everyone. Sasura, asura, manava. The demigods, the demons, and the human beings. Rupa, audharya. By the exquisite beauty and bodily features. Vaya, youth. Varna, complexion. Mahima, glories. Akshipta, agitated. Chetasa, their minds. Translation. Because of her exquisite beauty, her bodily features, her youth, her complexion, and her glories, everyone, including the demigods, the demons and the human beings desired her. They were attracted because she is the source of all opulences. Purport. Who in this world does not want to possess wealth, beauty, and the social respectability that come from these opulences? People generally desire material enjoyment, material opulence, and the association of aristocratic family members. Bhogaishvarya Prasaktanam. Material enjoyment entails money, beauty, and the reputation they bring, which can all be achieved by the mercy of the goddess of fortune. The goddess of fortune, however, never remains alone. As indicated in the previous verse by the word Bhagavat Para, she is the property of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and is enjoyable only by him. If one wants the favor of the goddess of fortune, Mother Lakshmi, because she is by nature Bhagavat Para, one must keep her with Narayan. The devotees who always engage in the service of Narayan, Narayana Parayana, can easily achieve the favor of the goddess of fortune without a doubt. But materialists who try to get the favor of the goddess of fortune only to possess her for personal enjoyment are frustrated. Theirs is not a good policy. The celebrated demon Ravana, for example, wanted to deprive Ramachandra of Lakshmi, Sita, and thus be victorious. But the result was just the opposite. Sita, of course, was taken by force by Lord Ramachandra, and Ravana and his entire material empire were vanquished. The goddess of fortune is desirable for everyone, including human beings. But one should understand that the goddess of fortune is the exclusive property of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One cannot achieve the mercy of the goddess of fortune unless one prays both to her and to the Supreme Enjoyer, the Personality of Godhead. Om Gana Chimadandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militan Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda, Shri Advaita Gadadha, Shri Vasudhi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. How can we enjoy without the Supreme Personality of Godhead? That is the program of the material world. As Prabhupada writes in the beginning of the purport, who in this world doesn't want to possess wealth, beauty, and the social respectability that come from these opulences? Right away, we can feel our attachments. We want to make the material world an enjoyable place. And we're willing to practically adopt any means that will accomplish that goal. What is wrong with opulence? What is wrong with social respectability? What is wrong with wealth? Krishna knows that most devotees have difficulty handling those things. There's a saying that people sure act funny when they get a little money. We can see that amongst non-devotees, and we can also see it amongst devotees. How to handle wealth. Money occupies such a meditation for everyone, whether you have it or not. If you have money, you're thinking, what am I going to do with it? How to protect it? How to invest it? How to get more? And if you don't have money, of course, you're always thinking, how am I going to get it? And even you can be in denial that I never think about money. Believe me, I never think about money. That's also thinking about money. So what to do? If you want to find the major dynamics of your life, how the dynamics of your life are flowing, just follow the money trail. That means whether you're rich, poor, middle class, whatever. You can see so much of your life is bound up with money. Do I have enough for now? Do I have enough for the future? Did I make mistakes in the past? This goes on and on and on. It is not that prosperity is unknown to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's just that Bhagavatam is presenting a different path to prosperity. Indeed, the only viable path to prosperity. As you heard in yesterday's purport, the first prerequisite for peace is that all the wealth presented by Sri, the goddess of fortune, be offered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Everyone should give up his false proprietorship over worldly possessions and offer everything to Krishna. This is the teaching of the Krishna Consciousness Movement. Does that sound practical to you? Everyone should give up their false proprietorship over wealth and offer everything to Krishna. This is the teaching of the Krishna Consciousness Movement. What do you think? That is too much, right? Not really practical, right? But then I ask you, what is practical about the materialistic plans made with no regard for Krishna? Demonstrate the practicality of those plans. People today are economically bewildered in terms of their leaders having no solution for lasting prosperity. They're pulling their hairs this way and that way, what to do about the increasing inequality of wealth. Should some be very rich and some not have anything at all? Or so what if someone else is rich and you have nothing? Who cares? Tough on you. This just goes on and on and on. You can see that there is no practical solution to the problem of wealth and prosperity. Who gets it? Who should have it? Who shouldn't have it? The debates just go on and on and on. So why not listen to a solution that is outside the box? Apparently. Of course, the Bhagavatam solution is the box. But ignorant as we are in Kali Yuga, we think that the Bhagavatam is very super fantastic. I mean, just think. You're hearing about the churning of the milk ocean. And out of that milk ocean is coming all these substances and all these personalities. Just think of Srila Prabhupada translating this. He knows it's fact. But he also knows even so many of his own followers will have difficulty accepting this as factual. The churning of the milk ocean. Out comes the goddess of fortune. Before that, poison was there, and then Lord Shiva drank it all. Just think how the self-realized soul sees all that as factual, and yet at the same time knows that because of the tiny sense perception of Kali Yuga residents, they're going to have doubts. They're going to try how to evade the impact. Or let's just accept the essence of this story. Let's take some instruction from it, but there's no need for us to consider that it's factual. With our tiny senses, how do we know it is factual or not? As I often explain, 99% of the people today can't even understand the economic system they're operating in or the political system. Yet when they read Bhagavatam, they get a little edgy that, oh, this is too much. This is an extraordinary event, no doubt. The churning of the milk ocean. All the greatest personalities in the cosmos are there. Vishnu is there. Shiva has been there drinking poison. His wife, Bhavani, is pleased by his effort. She gave him permission to do it. Yes, you can drink the poison. And she was pleased by the result. You've heard about how out of the ocean of milk has come a Sarabi cow, and then there came a beautiful white horse, Uchchhtrava, a horse so beautiful that naturally you'd think only the demigods should possess this horse. But you heard how Indra held back. Usually Indra can get kind of greedy and lusty, but he held back. He didn't grab for the horse because he had been warned by the personality of Godhead. Don't take this horse. Why was the reason for that? Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that the Supreme Personality of Godhead didn't want Indra to take the horse. He wanted the demons to take the horse, as indeed what happened. Bali Maharaj took the horse for the demons. So that was the plan of Vishnu, so the demons would get very proud. Oh, just see what we have. There's a lot going on that is not immediately detectable by ordinary vision. And then Lakshmi Devi comes out of the ocean of milk, and she's distributing opulence everywhere. The demons, however, are going to be frustrated. We don't get the blessings of opulence. Just by the glance of Lakshmi Devi, prosperity is spreading everywhere. But the demons felt completely left out. You'll hear that. Not only did they feel left out, but they became depressed. They became frustrated. They became bewildered. So there's something for everyone in material existence. Krishna fulfills all desires. Through his gunavatars, through the demigods, through his agents, even the material desires are fulfilled according to your karma. So when the demons are frustrated, saddened, bewildered, we don't get the blessings of Lakshmi Devi. What came next? Varuni, the goddess of drunkenness. The demons got her. Okay, we can get stoned and everything will be all right. So you see, it's business as usual in the material world. When you're frustrated with material desires, you become intoxicated. So I often point out, how can the Western world, why just the Western world, even these days the Eastern world, how can it go on without intoxication? That is the only reward, besides illicit sex, for your hard labor. You take away the intoxication, and people have to face reality, which is very painful. How is it that a devotee can handle prosperity? It can only be done with the help of Krishna and Krishna's representative. With that kind of help, a devotee can handle prosperity and also poverty. And you see examples of both in the Bhagavatam, in Chaitanya Lila. It's not that bhakti is for the saintly kings only, like Prahlad Maharaj, Prithu Maharaj, Ambarish Maharaj. No. Sometimes Krishna will arrange that his dearest devotees are living in poverty-stricken circumstances, just so that it can be seen by those interested in seeing that bhakti is beyond all material considerations. Savai pumsa paro dharma ito bhakti adhokshade. Ahoituki means no hetu, no material cause, no material circumstances or dependencies can stop bhakti. So sometimes Krishna wants his devotees to demonstrate that. In terms of wealth, the possession of vast wealth cannot impede bhakti, or the opposite, poverty cannot impede bhakti. You look at the case of Sudama Vipra. When he went to see Krishna in Dwarka, only because he was pushed by his wife, who was right. We're householders. We need at least a tiny bit to eat. We need at least a few cloths to wrap around us. We don't even have that. They were trembling with hunger, emaciated. Their little hut had holes and it was collapsing. But Sudama Vipra, he was detached. So his wife kept trying to push him. Go see your old friend. Go see Krishna and Dwarka. He's the friend of the brahmanas. Sudama Vipra's reply was, well, I'm not a brahmana, so I'm disqualified. I'm a Brahma Bandhu. He takes care of all devotees. Okay, fine. I'm not a devotee. I'm not surrendered. So there's no point in me going. And he was thinking, of course, why should I go see Krishna just to get material opulence. But his wife was very clever. She told him, look, I can understand, in other words, she's saying, I can understand you don't want to approach and ask Krishna for anything. But all you have to do is go there and just stand there. And the Lord's associates, they'll see. And they'll give you something. He's very clever. Finally, Sudama left for Dwarka with his own motivation in regard to this economic crisis. You see, both he and his wife were right. She was right. We're grihasthas. We need a little something, at least one cloth that doesn't have holes in it. We need a little rice so that she stops shivering from hunger because she's giving whatever tiny bit of food they had to her husband. She's right. And Sudama's right. I don't want to ask Krishna for anything material. So he decided, I'll just go, taking advantage of her request. I'll just go to see Krishna, that's all. That way, I'll satisfy her, and I won't betray my principles of not asking for anything material. So you know what happened when he got to Dwarka and how Krishna treated him. And the Acharyas explain that Krishna was thinking, how did my devotee fall into such poverty? Krishna himself was wondering. And apparently, he didn't give Sudama anything. Sudama left the next morning to go back to his hovel, his wrecked little hut. And he was just as materially penniless as he was before. What would you have done in that situation? You would have been angry. I've done 5 years of devotional service. Krishna's not taking care of me. I haven't gotten this. I haven't gotten that. I even got the darshan of Krishna, and he still gave me nothing. What kind of spiritual path is this? Right? We would have been resentful. How could Krishna let this happen to me? Yes. We all feel that Krishna owes us something. That's the nature of being a conditioned devotee. Of course, we should take care of devotees, but at the same time, a real devotee doesn't place demands on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We take our situation as the result of our own karma and that we should be in a much worse situation. So just put yourself in Sudama's shoes. You're leaving the palace of Dwarka, the palace occupied by Krishna's chief wife, Rukmini, and you're going away with nothing. Of course, Sudama got such intimate treatment from Krishna. Krishna sat him on the bedstead of Rukmini and worshipped him. Krishna snatched the cheap, hard rice that Sudama had brought as a gift but didn't want to give it. But still, in terms of material wealth, remember, we got to follow the money line, follow the money trail. That money trail in Sudama Vipra's life led nowhere to the same place as when he started out for Dwarka. So then, what is Sudama's mindset as he's going home with nothing on the money trail, nothing in the bank, no donation, zero? Of course, there were so many spiritual opulences, but right, we don't want to put too much emphasis on spiritual opulences. Doesn't pay the bills, right? So he's walking home as penniless as he was before. And what is he thinking? What's his mindset? How wonderful this is. How glorious Krishna is. He didn't give me a penny. How great is that? How great is he? He knows that if he had given me just a little bit of wealth, I'd fall down. How wonderful my Lord is. He didn't give it to me. This is so wonderful. This is so great. What do you make of that? You might think, you know, your you're following the wrong path. You're in the wrong association.
How wonderful Krishna is. He didn't give me anything. He knows where I'm at. And what is Krishna thinking?
Back in Dwarka, Krishna's thinking, I couldn't give him anything because I don't have enough for reciprocating with his bhakti. Even if I give him the opulence of Indra, it's not enough. I'm embarrassed.
Just see how personal everything is between Krishna and the devotee. You would never think that Krishna is thinking like that.
You probably would think Krishna is too, he's really too busy to deal with Sudama's issues and circumstances. Or Krishna's got too many parts and parcels. He can't keep up with all of them. Or he's too busy with Rukmini and the other 16,107 wives in Dwarka.
But no, Krishna's thinking like that. His bhakti is so overwhelming. He gave me that handful of cheap, hard rice, but it was so delicious. I have nothing to reciprocate for his devotion.
That's what Krishna's thinking. Not about the quality, the material quality of the rice, but about the bhakti of the offering. And that bhakti was so attractive that even though Sudama didn't want to give Krishna the gift that his wife had prepared of the cheapest quality, materially speaking, even though he didn't want to give it, Krishna snatched it from him, showing you that Krishna accepts devotion. He loves the devotion of his devotees. So Krishna is thinking, I can't reciprocate enough. I'm embarrassed. Therefore, I couldn't give him anything face to face because I don't have enough. The example the acharyas give is like the farmer offers prayers to get rain. And the rain feels embarrassed. This farmer is offering such devoted prayers. I can't reciprocate. Therefore, let me rain at night while the farmer is sleeping. Because I can't reciprocate enough. I'll have to do it. I'll have to send the rain in a clandestine way. So similarly, Krishna's thinking, I can't reciprocate with him face to face. I don't have enough for his bhakti. But when he gets home, he's going to see a surprise. And indeed, when Sudama Vipra got home, he couldn't even recognize his own residence. Of course, it had been transformed into something beyond a palace in the heavenly planets. And his wife was an extraordinarily beautiful young lady. So the irony is, Sudama, who was so austere and renounced, now has to live in unparalleled opulence. This is Krishna's sense of humor. You might think, well, Sudama, he's got a really good deal. Because we're looking at it from the viewpoint of someone who's attached to wealth, prosperity, luxury, social respectability. So we're thinking, good on you, Sudama. You've got it all. Don't worry about anything else. But the irony is that Sudama is actually attached to being renounced and super austere. So it's kind of like an ironic, we won't call it a joke, but it's an ironic twist that has happened to him. The one who is so attached to being austere and having nothing now has everything, and he's got to live with it. So you might say, well, I could go for that deal. I'd figure out how to live with it. Would you? Would you be able to handle it? If we look around the world, we see that the places that are materially nice with the good weather, the beaches, the balmy breezes, those are the most difficult places for devotees to become and remain serious in bhakti. I've seen this all over the world. Yes, Southern California is nice, but there are even nicer places. I have a ranking. I don't know if I told you before. Number 4 is Southern California.
Of course, we have many serious devotees in Southern California, but also there are many who have had difficulty in bhakti, and also many don't come to bhakti because, after all, Southern California seems, for the moment, to be sort of materially nice. That's number four. Number three, the East Coast of Australia, the Gold Coast, with towns with names like Surfer's Paradise or the Sunshine Coast. I'd say it's Southern California tripled in terms of material attractiveness. But it's very difficult for devotees to last there. Number two, Rio de Janeiro. The Brazilian devotees say, if you can remain a brahmachari in Rio de Janeiro for 5 years, you're ready to take sannyas. And number one, of course, Hawaii. As you know, Prabhupada said, if there's any place in this world that's on earth, that's heaven, it's Hawaii. So difficult to remain Krishna conscious there. Is prosperity actually our friend? Or is bhakti our friend? This is the point that the Bhagavatam is making. But let's look at California, since we're all in Southern California especially. I'll tell you some interesting facts. That now Toyota is moving their North American headquarters from Torrance, California, to Texas, outside of Dallas. You know, tax reasons and all sorts of things like that. But there's also another reason. They can't get any young talent. They can't attract young talent to their headquarters because young people can't afford California, you know, when they're just starting out in business. They can't have, you know. So Toyota's in a bind. They're thinking of succession. We've got an all-star team of older executives, but we can't bring any young talent in because the startup wages and salaries can't handle California living and the California lifestyle. So if we want our succession to go on, we got to move. But there's a problem in moving. They can attract more young people in Texas, but their present staff, what do you think they're thinking? We're not leaving California. So Toyota's offering them all kinds of inducement packages. You know, we'll increase your salary. We'll give you relocation packages, this or that. They're trying to retain their old staff while being in a position to attract a new staff, but the old staff doesn't want to leave California. And the lesson is already there from Nissan. Nissan moved from California some years ago to Kentucky. And so then they did a study of what happened after they moved. 30% of their staff just went back to California. So forget Kentucky. We'll give up our job. We just got to get back to California. So you see, prosperity and comfort play such an important role in everyone's life. Therefore, why shouldn't the Bhagavatam deal with it? So you have the example of Sudama Brahmana, who was happy, I don't have anything. But because the acharyas explained, he was a little too renounced. He was attached too much to vairagya in of itself. Therefore, in a sense, Krishna embarrassed him, sort of. Okay, you love to be so austere? Take more wealth than Indra has. And then there are other examples. Prahlad Maharaj, Prithu Maharaj, who didn't want any material benedictions, but they had to live in order to render service. They had to live in such opulence. It's very difficult for persons to understand the principle given by Narada Muni and Prahlad Maharaj. Tasyaiva heto prayateta kovida. Someone who's a kavi, who's actually intelligent, never strives for anything that's available anywhere in the material universe. No earthly opulence, and not even heavenly planets opulence. Because all that will come to you automatically according to your past karma. And time is like the conveyor belt that brings you your past karmic reactions. So why try for it when it's going to come to you automatically? So both Prahlad and Narada Muni give the same easy way to understand this point. You don't pray for your distress. It comes anyway. Similarly, you don't have to pray or strive for your material prosperity. What you do, you're going to get. So half of that sounds like we can assimilate it. I don't strive for distress. Yes, I still get distress. Okay, I can accept that. But I don't strive for my material happiness and I still get what I'm due? Logically, I can understand the point, but in terms of lifestyle, I can't accept it. Why? Because we're so ingrained. What's so ingrained in us is this mode of passion idea that I strive for my wealth. I strive for my prosperity. I strive for my happiness. It's a lot of it is up to me. Yeah, some's due to my genetics, how happy a disposition I have, but mostly it's all up to me. Some may be due to God, whoever he is or however, but most of all it's my endeavor, and I can't stop endeavoring. So this point by Narada Muni and Prahlad Maharaj requires some deep thought. And that's what a kavi is, a spiritual intellectual. How is it that time is going to bring me automatically all the material prosperity and material happiness that I'm due? I don't have to strive for it. By thinking about this principle given by Prahlad and Narada Muni, you actually become peaceful. And then when you're peaceful, you can start to analyze this false sense of proprietorship that causes us to neglect the principle of Bhagavat Para, that Lakshmi Devi, the goddess of fortune, is the exclusive property of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and exclusively meant to be enjoyed by Krishna. So you can't pry Lakshmi Devi away from Krishna. And as we were discussing in the beginning, if you look at the economic perplexities and complexities of the world today, you can see that after hundreds of years of so-called modern economic expansion, they're still bewildered. It's just that while everyone is bewildered how to have lasting prosperity, some people are busy making a temporary profit. But nevertheless, the bewilderment increases. Perhaps it is not so pie in the sky and fairy tale, the statement that everyone should give up false proprietorship over worldly possessions and offer everything to Krishna. But we need examples of how that is so. Our society of devotees is meant to demonstrate what is in the books. By reading the books, people become curious. Could this be so? Even they'll accept that there's the churning of the milk ocean. A humble person, a fortunate person, will think, there's a lot that I don't know. Could be that there's a milk ocean. And the way these purports are presented, they're so, how do you say, magisterial, they're so authoritative. That's what I thought when I started reading this as a non-devotee. Well, this person's really convinced about all this stuff. Who am I to say no? Every sentence just emanates conviction, realization, authoritativeness. What do I know? And Krishna is in the heart of the readers. He makes the readers fortunate enough to understand Bhagavatam, especially when the reader has contact with devotees. And then, after contact with devotees, the reader can render some service and also hear Bhagavatam in the association of devotees. Then you see the so-called the magic in action. So let's not be intimidated by the otherworldliness of Srimad Bhagavatam. Srila Prabhupada put so much emphasis on the message of the Bhagavatam, the distribution of the Bhagavatam. We're not acting alone. We are carrying out the desires of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who's in everyone's heart. Are there any questions? First of all, any comments by our illustrious senior Vaishnav? All right. Silence. Any questions? Yes. Which places are many devotees? Where are they from? Exactly. They've come attracted by the excellent management and the presence of senior Vaishnavas like you. This is New Dwarka. It's, you know, it's always been a nicely managed place most of the time, and certainly now it's nicely managed, and devotees, you know, want some managemental sanity. You can't believe they want to be cared for. They want a good temple program. So they come here from all over the world. But if you count the numbers who are simply from Southern California, and then they're, you want to find out where the most devotees are outside of India? Go to Ukraine. Thousands upon thousands of devotees. But its place is a material disaster. Materially, it's crazy. You know, they just shot down a passenger plane and killed 300 people. That's Ukraine. That's standard. It's materially nuts. But spiritually, oh, the bhakti is so intoxicating. The bhakti of those devotees there. But you never want to live there. In any case, those who stick seriously to the bhakti path, even in Southern California, they make spiritual advancement because bhakti is beyond material circumstances. It's just a little tough for those who are not so serious. They get mowed down very easily. Anything? He's first, I think.
Thank you, Maharaj. You were mentioning names like Prahlad Maharaj and Sudama Vipra. Out of millions of people like that, millions, maybe one achieves that maturity or that understanding of surrender and everything. So you were saying practical reasons. So not for practical point of view, I've seen for 35 years people coming here. After 5 years, maybe 10 years, they go back and get jobs. And so the practical reason, do we as leaders in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness carry a responsibility for providing for those people who want Krishna, but at the same time they get caught up outside in jobs, meaning the practical reason will be probably varanasram dharm, like encouraging more. Can you speak something about that?
Well, if you want to go down that road through parampara, you have to consider that Prabhupada's vision for dealing with that was farm communities. Who wants to live on a farm? You know what farms mean? Hard work. Isn't it much better to be a slave at an office in the IT world under so much pressure that your mind's about to split, your brains are in shrivels, and you're in constant anxiety about whether you're going to be downsized and the competitiveness and the stresses and strains, we think that's much better. So if you want to look at your question through the lens of parampara, then you'd see that Prabhupada did think about that. But his solution was something that maybe we're all a little reluctant to various degrees to embrace. Why do you want to live on a farm when you can live in Southern California? Of course, if you have a farm in Southern California also, then, yeah, okay. But anyway, my point is that was Prabhupada's vision for how to engage so many people who otherwise aren't strong enough to live the strict life of temples. So you have to decide for yourself whether that vision has any practical significance in this day and age.
So Maharaj, the phrase that we use, simple living, higher thinking, is applicable only to a very small, tiny group, because as far as preaching goes, if we mention that word for people who live in the city, it sounds very impractical.
You can live simply in the city. Even the non-devotees know that. There's so many online courses of how to live simply in the city. Did you know that? There's a whole simplicity movement amongst non-devotees in regarding the environmental crisis, in regarding people becoming so stressed and depressed. I've seen it myself. There are books about it, how to live simply in the city. You can live a simple life. There's simplicity.com or something like that. These things are going on. And here we are saying, oh, no, we don't know if anyone will be attracted to our message. Here's one last point. If you want to be effective in your outreach, just forget about the 60s. It didn't happen. Because by becoming so caught up in what happened in the 60s, we're not looking at what's going on today and the right market that exists today. We're still, to some degree, caught up in the throes of countercultural movement that faded decades ago. So much so that we're not looking at the extraordinary opportunities available today. So yes, there are people who are thinking about simplicity very deeply. I know one, the top environmental leader in North America, he has come up with a solution. How to keep people happy when they're living in rural areas. Because he realized, if people move back to the rural areas, what will be their entertainment? What will be their diversion? So he said, what's the solution? The internet. They'll be able to tune into the internet, even in the most remote areas, and that will keep them enlivened. And, of course, you know, the internet's mostly trash. 80% of all internet usage is pornography. In other words, he's got no solution. Back we go to spiritual solutions for material situations. All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.